kulture sećanja u dijalogu. Slušate podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo.
This is Memory Cultures in Dialogue, the podcast of the Humanitarian Law Center from Belgrade. My name is Jelena Đurejinović. Today we are talking about the NATO intervention in Yugoslavia in 1999 as an ambivalent space of experience and a site of memory in Serbia. Here with me today is Elisa Satjukov from the University of Leipzig, whose book The Other Side of the Intervention, A History of Serbian Experience of the NATO Bombing in 1999 was published 2 years ago for the German publishing house Transcript. The book examines the very complex experiences of Serbian society during the NATO bombing. In your book, you're studying the NATO intervention in Serbia as an ambivalent experience. What does that mean?
It's a very complex issue, and we see, if we look at this NATO intervention, all the ambivalences of the international responsibility in conflicts. And I think this is also a very current topic if we look at the Russian invasion in Ukraine, and actually this case of Kosovo. I think we can learn a lot for the situation at the very moment. And with ambivalences, I mean different things I look at in my book. And the first thing is the question of the responsibility for Serbian war crimes at the one hand, and the question of how can we end this war? So is there an easy solution? And is bombing a way to end the war? And it turned out it was a possibility to end the war, but still was peace the thing that was achieved with that? And if we then look, and this is like the ambivalent part of it, if we then looked how it turned out, we saw on the one hand that, of course, Kosovo declared their independence in 2008, but still like the relationship between Kosovo and Serbia is still not clarified, still NATO is present, and then the situation in Kosovo was established that was similar to Bosnia before. And on the Serbian side, we had also a situation that all those who were fighting for a democratic Serbia all throughout the 90s were now confronted with bombs by the democratic West they were like looking up to, and they were very much torn into their national Serbian community and the politics of Milosevic, who needed this war in order to stay in power, at least for a short period of time after this bombing. And we have this like on this bigger picture. So, and also the outcome, if we look now at Serbian memory politics, we will talk about this later, with Vucic as a president, we have also on the longer perspective, we have a very ambivalent outcome if it comes to how now the bombing serve as narrative of victimization, which also leads to the fact that Serbian war crimes in the Yugoslav wars are kind of overshadowed by this own experience of the NATO bombing, of becoming a victim to NATO, which doesn't mean that there are no personal experiences and that people weren't like hardly affected by this bombing. So this is also something to keep in mind, not to say it's okay to bomb people in order to gain like peace in the bigger picture, but to have both sides in your head. So like, what can be the outcome of answering with more violence to a violent conflict? And I will go into more detail afterwards. But if we look at like the situation of the bombing, we also see like these ambivalences of being part of this Serbian national community, and which was very much also instrumentalized by the Milosevic regime with this target signs and saying we are all victims of the NATO. And on the other hand, being especially, as we are here talking with the in your podcast, being part of the Serbia opposition and not having like any more grounds to react and to counter like these Serbian nationalist regimes in this situation of war.
You mentioned the people and how the NATO intervention affected the people. So how did people live through these 78 days, and what different strategies did they develop to deal with the intervention in everyday life?
before the beginning of the bombing on 24th of March, people were just not able to believe that something like this is going to happen. And this is something, of course, as historians, we know from all the wars. It's just not even, if you know, and we had this in Ukraine, if you see the tanks on the other side, you cannot believe that they're really crossing like the border. Yeah, like in the middle of Europe, in the Serbian capital at the end of the 20th century, there will be a war, and how can this look like? And so people just, yeah, repressed this idea, and this changed then with 24th of March. And then happened what always happens in this kind of extreme situation. People were panicking, of course, because first they could not imagine what kind of war is going to happen. And then they thought of wars they knew, and some of them knew war from their personal experience. So Belgrade was bombed before in 1941. And we know this, I think, from Ukraine, but also from the pandemic. So what people do is, of course, they hoard groceries, they buy whatever they can buy in order to have it. Yeah, they sought shelter with their nearest people, their closest people. So everyone was like looking for the community of their loved ones. This is, I think, a very human thing to do in these kind of situations. So the bus station in Belgrade was packed with people who tried to come out to the city, but also because the city was perceived as more dangerous than the villages. And in addition to these like personal reactions, there were of course the political ones. So the state of war was proclaimed and shelters were prepared for the people. Schools and universities stopped operating, and there was a ban on gatherings in the public, except for, we will talk about this later, the so-called anti-war concerts organized by the state, and the anti-war so-called anti-war demonstrations. Well-known Alexander Vučić was the minister of information at the time, and narrative which is until today central to the cultural of remembrance of the NATO bombing in Serbia, that the NATO intervention is a kind of conspiracy of the American New World Order. So, and besides the media situation, of course, the men were drafted into the military. So Yugoslavia waged a defensive war against NATO on the one hand, but it also paramilitary troops and the ones who were active in the Bosnian war, like Arkan and others, were now mobilizing for ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. And this was also a situation that happened in these first days, that before like the international presence in Kosovo, there were a lot of internationals present and watching the situation in 98 and even before. And now everyone left the country, and the only ones who are coming in were like the paramilitary troops from Serbia. So we have this kind of mobilizing for two wars. And I would say there was, after this initial panic, there was a relatively quick phase that I would describe as adaptation to the circumstances. And this is also something we knew from other kind of emergency situations. So people learned in a short time what kind of war they were dealing with. NATO bombed mainly at night. NATO was targeting so-called military objectives, what means that this is everything which is important for the military infrastructure, such as bridges and roads and fabrics and so on. But still, they learned that these kind of military infrastructure was often close to people's homes. And also that what is a military infrastructure is also debatable, especially the case of the radio television Serbia shows that is how controversial this question was discussed also from the Western side. So for NATO, who established this as a legitimate target because it was spreading like the war propaganda, but Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other human rights organizations were condemning it because it's like a civilian infrastructure. So it was not that clear in all cases what means a military target, and also these military targets were close to people's homes. So this is like the kind of situation people were facing, but still it made it more calculable, I would say, compared to other wars, and especially compared to the situation in Kosovo, where people were confronted with air raids on the one hand, and with the Serbian paramilitary troops and the Serbian expulsions on the other hand. And to end this question, after a while, I would say starting from May airway, it's really intensified. And so everyday life got really hard and a lot of people were just exhausted. And I would say in a bigger picture that for those people who find new normalities, so there are different kind of strategies to get a new daily life. In this kind of censorship, it was just hard to know what is actually going on. And I think this is also something I was hearing a lot and doing in interviews. So this kind of black box situation, you have like the Serbian TV telling like the Serbian propaganda and their perspective of the story. And at the same time, you have like the Western media, everyone was watching, who are also, of course, reporting their part of the story, and just to find out what is a useful information in order to react according to the situation. I think this is very important for all the people. And I think there's a very interesting example, because I was also looking at digital sources. So like the internet became for the first time, I would say for those who had access, that were not many, but still for those who had access, it became for the first time a very important place to also share information, to share war experience, like at the same time they were happening. And this is also something new in war reporting. And for the younger people, I think we will come to this later. I think they take a very special role in these kind of adapting strategies.
Speaking of young people, some of us who were like me, young teenagers in Serbia in 1999, remember very well being drawn into these gatherings that you mentioned earlier on bridges that were allegedly planned to be destroyed, bearing stickers and patches with the target sign on them protesting the air raids. So while the country was being bombed, there were these protests, concerts, even wild parties going on. How do you explain that?
Yeah, so the initial need was to gather and to kind of cope with the situation. And these concerts were established for this, but the Milosevic government very quickly took advantage of this situation, and they kind of captured this concept for their nationalist purposes. And so the target signs came in, and also this idea of the living shields gathering on the bridges, which came from Mira Markovic. And yeah, and it served this very purpose to support the regime's message of the illegal attack of the Yugoslavia and the Serbian citizens as innocent victims to the NATO. But I would very much separate these state organized events from the wild parties, because I think that this need to gather and also to like celebrate life while facing death is also something we witness in other wars. And I think it's very much dependent on how severe is the war situation, and if it allows people to have these kind of parties. So are there longer breaks between the bombings to fulfill this need of just forgetting about the war and finding some kind of normalcy? And in Belgrade, for example, there was the situation. There were like these in-between times where you could forget about it, but it wasn't the same in Kosovo. It wasn't like that in Sarajevo. So I think this is very also much important to keep in mind.
Slušate podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo. Kulture sećanja u dijalogu.
How are these very diverse experiences of people who were in Serbia in 1999 related to the overall culture of remembrance of the NATO intervention in general? So the connection between the personal memory and then an experience and then the official culture of remembrance as it developed since 1999.
So I would say it's very important to look at these very first months after the peace agreement of Kumanovo and the end of the NATO bombing and the Kosovo war, and also the experience very much differs. So if you like part of the Serbian community in Kosovo who are now fleeing, and also the Roma community to Serbia, and like always with wars, it's not ending with an agreement, but it goes on different places. So people were facing very different situation, especially in Kosovo. For the people in Serbia, it was a time of mourning, of course, for those who lost people, but also to finding out what is going to be next and to find a future perspective after these last war, after a decade of war. And I think the situation in the summer of 1999 very much speaks to it. So on the one hand, you have like this movement of peace, which were evolving and really trying to bring change to the political situation. And then you have like a society which is traumatized by war. And I think there is an event that very much speaks to the situation. And this is the sun eclipse in August 1999. You of course remember it, and it was like in all over Europe, it was like a huge spectacle, and everyone was like looking outside with these glasses and just watching this natural spectacle happening. And there's a very interesting article about the situation in Serbia that people were just all inside their houses because they were so afraid of what is going to happen, what comes next out of the air. And I think this I found that so striking to see how people were struggling with this whole situation and do not know what to believe. So there is the Serbian government saying, oh my God, don't go out. So I think this was a very, very hard situation just to know how to deal what was happening, but also to find out to a new normality. And most people knew that this normality could not happen, or well, I don't know if most people, but more and more people knew that it's not going to happen with Milosevic. And then we have in this very early time the first anniversary happening of the NATO bombing. And this is very interesting, and I speak in an article about the making of 24 March, because here we see with still Milosevic, it was the major or the hegemonic narrative of victimization, which was of course already established during the bombing, but was now kind of manifested in this first anniversary. So there were like on the 24th of March, like different kind of wavelengths happening. Milosevic was on Avala and having his speech, and you have also in front of RTS, it's like the remembering of the victims of the bombings, but not of the Milosevic government responsibility, which also has its part in like the bombing and the victims of the television bombing. So you have these very one-sided interpretation of the bombing and all these kind of anniversary gatherings that we then were facing for a long period of time. This was like initiated. When you ask about the personal memory and experience and the official culture of remembrance, we find both connected, especially in this first year, and of course changed over time. And this is maybe something we're going to talk about.
I'm interested in what happens after the overthrow of Milosevic and after the 5th of October 2000 and before 2012, when the Serbian Progressive Party comes to power. How did the politics of memory, but also culture of remembrance, develop in this post-Milosevic period, early post-Milosevic period?
What I did in my research, I can say that we can divide three different phases of memory politics and of cultures of remembrance. And the first one I was just telling, this is like the making of this 24th of March and this like anniversary, which is very much connected with this one-sided memory of NATO bombing Serbia, but not connected at all to Serbia responsible for war crimes in Kosovo. And this also speaks to the date, because it's like not the end of the overall war, which was on 8th of June, to the Kosovo war, which is remembered, but it is like the beginning of the bombing. And we can say, even though we have different kind of changes, this did not change until today. But what changed after October 2000 is, of course, and you know this much better than I am, of an overall politics of reconciliation. So we have like the collaboration with the ICTY, also in in terms of Kosovo. We have like politics of remembrance when it comes to the Yugoslav wars in January, in terms of the remembering of Srebrenica, of Vukovar, and so on. So I think there are efforts to also get to a critical way of dealing with the past. And there are politicians who were doing this more than others and also who changed their political stance over time. Yeah, of course, Dzinjic was a very important figure, and the assassination of Dzinjic was also a very traumatic experience for a lot of people, which somehow also put an end to, I think, a lot of hopes that people had in this after Milosevic future. But still, also with Tadic, as we had a really long time, more than 10 years of democratic government and like the accession to the EU talks and so on. So it was like a long time where the NATO bombing didn't fit at all in the overall picture. Because like, when it comes to like being coming closer to the West, becoming a democratic country, it's just hard to deal with the fact that NATO was bombing Serbia. So what was happening is that it disappeared from the public sphere. Still, there were like the WEF layings taking place, but on the 24th of March, and different kind of communities were, of course, remembering the mourning, the people they have lost. And also, of course, the nationalist groups were still like capturing this 24th of March for their own purposes and for their own demonstrations and gatherings. And this was all also taking place at the same time. But like from this official politics sphere, it wasn't a very big deal. And to that amount that even like this monument in front of the main station all the victims and defenders of the fatherland from 91 to 99, which is like really much speaking to this kind of effort to put like the Serbian victims in the line with all the other victims somehow of the Yugoslav wars, which doesn't speak to Serbia's central role as a perpetrator in this war. So this was erected on the 24th of March, I guess it was in 2012, if I'm right. It wasn't like almost secretly happening. And so you have these kind of ongoing also like nationalist narratives, but they weren't just not that present as they were before. And on the other hand, there were no efforts to really, I would say, to really question this Kosovo is Serbia idea. And this becomes very clear also with then the declaration of independence in Kosovo and like the Serbian riots happening, and also politicians saying we will never question the role of Kosovo. And this is also something I'm still wondering why, if there was a chance to be more progressive in this very, very time of the democratic change towards a solution with Kosovo and not staying with like these initial narratives of Kosovo belonging to Serbia. And then we have, and you were just mentioning, and when we have again a major change with Vucic's renaissance way back to power, we see this happening in 2015 with the first time that the central anniversary was happening in Belgrade, and for the first time after Milosevic as a very central event. So in front of the Generalstab building, the whole government was gathering. Dodik, the president of the Republika Srpska, was present, and it was aired on prime time in the national TV. And this was very much a continuation of the memory politics, of the initial memory politics of the Milosevic time. And so this comes not as a surprise. It continues in terms of language, and this is also important. So this term of the NATO aggression, and it somehow disappeared throughout the 2000s. And then it was mostly the talk of NATO bombing. And then it came back, the NATO aggression. And so we have really a continuation or follow-up on these Milosevic rhetorics, but also on the initial narratives. And what changes is that the slogan of we will never forget but we will forgive you. So it's like kind of this the ambition to make the NATO bombing as a central lieu de mémoire and like the for the Serbian society, but at the same time saying we are ready for a future, but in the future Serbia looks strong and Vucic is the one who leads to this better future. So I think, and with this we are coming back to your first question of the personal memories, and of course people are affected by those. If you look at these kind of anniversaries, and the first one in Belgrade, there is like a whole memory show happening on the stage. So there is a choir singing, and then there is like a theater play. There is this small girl, Milica Rakic, which was such a tragic story for everyone, like a 3-year-old who was hit by a shrapnel and died in the NATO bombing, and who now kind of appeared again as a ghost, and as a 25-year-old Milica Rakic, and saying what would have happened to her if she not have died by the NATO bombing. So these kind of emotions were now very much in the center of the remembrance of the NATO bombing. And of course, people were affected by it because it spoke to their mournings and to their initial traumatic experiences. But on the other hand, it had an interesting effect, especially for the younger generation.
Of course, also 99 bombing is for most people in the territory of present-day Serbia the most direct experience of the 90s wars in general. And at the level of personal memory, it is also completely detached of what was going somewhere else, like in Kosovo, and the connection between it, and which is the same in the official narratives. For the end, what would you say, what do you think, why did the NATO bombing, and at the same time also the defensive, heroic war of the Serbian forces, why did, during the Kosovo war and the NATO bombing, of course, why did they surface as the central site of memory in Serbia since 2015?
Because it goes along with an overall nationalist shift in Serbian politics. So I think it's just one side of many where we see this happening. And of course, memory politics are always a very important field for politicians to present their political messages. And we see it also when it comes to media freedom, with the wall of critics against Vucic's government, and also when it comes to politics that are still very much looking at Russia and taking the example of Kosovo as an explanation of what is happening now with the Russian invasion in Ukraine. So there are a lot of reasons, but I think the main one is the one you were just saying, that it is the only war experience, or direct war experience, most people had in Serbia. And with this, it very much, it is the possibility to not deal with all the war crimes Serbia is responsible for. And memory politics is one instrument. Also, maybe also kind of a practical reason, because Milosevic was, as I said, Vucic was very much involved in the NATO bombing and the Kosovo war. So it's nothing new to invent, but it's, I think, very, very much also comes from his whole history and as a politician.
Thank you, Alyssa, for sharing some of your insights with us. For those of you listening to us who read German, the book The Other Side of the Intervention is open access and available on the website of the publisher. And while we are waiting hopefully for a translation in English or Serbian. This was Memory Cultures in Dialogue, the podcast of the Humanitarian Law Center from Belgrade.
Slušali ste podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo.